Spock.
Yes.
About those colorful metaphors that we've discussed. I don't think you should try using them anymore.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, you haven't quite got the knack of it.
I see.
And another thing, it's not always necessary to tell the truth.
I cannot tell a lie.
I don't mean lie. But you could exaggerate.
Exaggerate?
Exaggerate. You've done it before. Can't you remember?
The hell, I can't.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, and Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. If you haven't heard our previous episode, you might want to go back and start there. Because now we're going to pick up, and that's my special guest, Jim Yelton, who I'll introduce in just a moment. We are going to pick up with the second half of the six original Star Trek movies and cover them in a bit of detail. Here to discuss this with me is Jim Yelton. Welcome aboard the show again, Jim.
Thanks, man.
Jim, remind folks who haven't heard the previous show who you are and how awesome your stuff is and why you're on here.
Well, I'm glad that you think it's awesome.
Absolutely.
I'm a writer. I'm a director of stage productions. I've done 10. The last one was Sherlock Holmes, The Final Adventure, which was really cool. I'm a writer of science fiction, fantasy, superhero drama, all stuff that's in your wheelhouse. Our new project that we're working on is a re-release of our 15th anniversary edition of The Swindlers of Doom, which is an epic space opera. And we're really excited about that. People can check it out at midnight-entertainment.com. And I love Star Trek more than anything in the world.
And that's why you're the perfect person to have on here talking about it. So, again, in our previous episode, we covered Star Trek The Motion Picture Plus 2 and 3. So now we're just going to jump right on in and talk about 4, 5, and 6. Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Avoid the planet Earth at all costs. We are under the attack of an orbiting probe.
Notify all stations. Starfleet emergency, red alert.
Earth is on the edge of destruction.
We cannot survive unless a way can be found to respond to the probe.
The key to saving the future.
Spock, you're talking about the end of every life on Earth.
Can be found only in the past.
We're going to attempt time travel.
Sulu, take us home.
These are the voyages of the crew of the starship Enterprise.
Judging by the pollution content of the atmosphere, I believe we have arrived at the latter half of the 20th century.
Stardate 1986.
San Francisco.
Our own world is waiting for us to save it.
They have 24 hours.
Everybody remember where we parked. Break up.
To complete their mission.
It looked like a cadet review.
We will beam in tonight, collect the photons, and beam out.
I want you all to be very careful.
Without being discovered.
We have an intruder.
All right, who are you?
You're not exactly catching us at our best.
That much is certain.
This is an extremely primitive and paranoid culture.
What does it mean, exact change?
Many of their customs will doubtless take us by surprise.
We're ready for beam out.
My transporter power is down to minimal. Got to bring you in one at a time.
You're from outer space.
No, I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space. Let's do our job and get out of here.
Freeze! Take off, can you hear me? Freeze! I lost it.
Who are you? With you.
You can't. Our next stop is the 23rd century.
Full power now, sir.
Shields at maximum.
Steady. Hold on tight, Lassie.
Can we make breakaway speed?
Well, that's all I can give you!
Book 8.
Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
I have to tell this quick little story. Star Trek III, which we didn't mention previously, Star Trek III actually ended with the Enterprise being destroyed. And being done for the first time, really, I believe, that was a pretty effective thing. They've done it several times since then, TV and movies and whatnot, but that was a pretty effective thing. And so when I heard that Star Trek IV was about to come out or was in production, I mentioned it to somebody where I worked at the time. And they said, no, they're not going to do another one. They blew up the Enterprise. And so, but I believe at the end of Star Trek III, don't they get a new Enterprise?
Not at the end of three.
Oh, it's the end of four. That's right. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So four is all about getting back and dealing with a sudden, unexpected plot development that kind of occupies them for the whole movie, and then they finally get back home and get a new Enterprise. Yeah, so Star Trek IV was kind of a surprise in a lot of ways. In many ways, it stands out, I think, among the six, as being sort of it's generally considered, would you agree, it's generally considered the one that non-Star Trek fans liked.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a lot of reasons for it, mm-hmm. but I think coming off of the first, you know, we talked in the first episode, like two and three formed like the first two legs of a trilogy and that you had to do a four.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of buzz coming off of Star Trek II with Spock dying and then Star Trek III, he comes back and it was kind of like, okay, now what happens? Like, you know, there was a natural progression from two to three, but then once Spock was back, you know, everybody was kind of like anticipating, okay, now what?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do they do? They don't have a ship. They're not in Starfleet. Like, how are they going to be Star Trek without some of these essential elements to the story?
Mm-hmm. And so they basically just get parachuted down on their own, like a commando team, having to deal with an issue that nobody else can deal with, and they don't even have the Enterprise.
Well, and you know, I mentioned in the last episode with Star Trek III, the through line for the plot was pretty obvious. They're going to go get Spock.
Yeah.
In the beginning of Star Trek IV, there's a very simple scene where Kirk, you know, is asking, he's polling the crew as to what they want to do. They've got the Klingon bird of prey that they kind of captured at the end of Star Trek III, mm-hmm. and they've all decided they're going to fly it back to Earth and, you know, take whatever punishment Starfleet wants to dole out for what they did in Star Trek III. That's a very simple through line that, okay, we're just going to go home. And in fact, you know, it's the voyage home.
Yeah.
So, you know, clearly that's what the movie's going to be about. And
In the same way,
you can't make a movie about that. You have to hang something else onto it.
And, yeah, I'm gonna say it's in the same way that the Odyssey is the voyage home.
Exactly, like
the voyage home, and all this crap happens.
Right. So you know, you have to come up with something that's going to keep them from getting home, or you know, cause them to have an adventure.
Yeah.
And you know, much like I talked about with Star Trek III, where Kirk was very determined to do what he was going to do. You have a probe come from somewhere in space, come to Earth and start wrecking all sorts of havoc with the weather. And it's sending a signal to Earth that nobody knows what it means. A very, very simplified science fiction plot, if there ever was one.
And something of an echo of V'ger.
Exactly. And because Kirk is Kirk and he has the experience that he has dealing with these things, you know, why not just, you know, we're going to slingshot around the sun. We're going to go back in time because we figured out that this probe is trying to talk to humpback whales. And since there aren't any humpback whales, we need to go get some. I mean, there's not a lot of discussion about it.
No,
once they know that the signal is meant for humpback whales, he's pretty quick to say, oh, well, we're just going to go back in time.
It is kind of, when you put it that way, though, when you put the basic plot down, it does seem kind of ridiculous. Star Trek IV, the voyage home to get some whales and move them through time.
Exactly.
It's just right. An odd, you know, Sure. I mean, can you just imagine somebody saying, okay, well, we've fought V'ger, we've fought Khan, we've dealt with the Klingons. Now what we need is a space vehicle thing that wants to talk to whales. That's the logical next step in the Star Trek saga, is aliens that demand to talk to whales, or else bye-bye planet.
Well, and it's funny because, yeah, and I actually, in talking to people, because, you know, like we said at the beginning, 4 is generally considered the favorite,
yeah,
of more people than the other ones, non-fans and fans alike, and there's a lot to like about it. But when you actually think about the plot, you know, the plot is we're going to go back in time because we need humpback whales. Okay, so what are some of the dilemmas that they come across? What are some of the roadblocks that are put in their place? Well, they need to build an aquarium. And
aboard a Klingon ship, by the way.
Aboard a Klingon ship, yeah. They have to make the cargo bay into an aquarium to hold the humpback whales.
Sure.
They have to find 2 humpback whales that are not going to be missed, so that you don't have the butterfly effect.
Right, yeah.
And then, of course, the best part of all of the roadblocks, they've got some issue with the dilithium crystals on the Klingon bird of prey, and somebody needs to go collect something from a nuclear reactor in order to make them recrystallize.
So send the Russian.
Yeah. So basically you're out of gas.
Yeah.
Like you don't have what you need to propel your ship. So we're going to build an aquarium, we're going to buy some fish, and we're going to send Chekhov to go get some gas. That's the 3 major roadblocks they have to overcome in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And and in each case, they make it work very well with the characters, because, like I said, this is during the Cold War. So you get Chekhov, the Russian, going to the naval yards, of course.
Yeah.
Nothing can go wrong there.
He's on the nuclear aircraft carrier, yeah.
Yeah, nothing can go wrong there. And then but you have Scotty doing the engineering work on the plexiglass, teaching them how to make transparent aluminum, isn't that right?
Yes.
And my favorite thing is that they actually – I almost flipped out in the theater. The place that Scotty goes to get his material, did you know notice the name of that place?
No.
Plexicorp.
Oh, is
it? Yeah, man. I was like rubbing my eyes going, did I just see my name on the wall of this building? And it was Plexicorp.
Your name's
yeah.
everywhere.
Yeah, so that was kind of cool. But, yeah, and they also have kind of the love interest with the lady that works at the aquarium or whatever, right? And she actually – doesn't she go into the future?
Yeah, she does. She ends up going back with them.
I would have liked to have known more about what became of her.
Well, you know, at the end of the movie, she does make the comment to Kirk that she was assigned to a science vessel that was going to track the whales and, you know, help them repopulate or do whatever whales do. So, you know, it was kind of one of those things where it was yet another humorous throwaway, because Kirk had thought that they had a moment and that maybe there was something there between the two of them. And she was like, no, I'm going to go on my own ship. Have a good life. See ya.
Gonna go hang out with the whales.
I'm good.
Yeah, all Kirk.
And this was actually, you know, this everybody loves it because it's the most humorous of the 6, and there's a lot of comedy to be mined from these 23rd century people being stuck in the 20th century
and
having to deal
is.
With things.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's that it's the one that takes place in our time. So it was more relatable to the average layperson that doesn't get
exactly.
the whole future thing. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it is good. I mean, I liked it when it came out, and I still really enjoy it. It's one of the better ones, I think. Now let's go ahead and bring in Star Trek V, and we can again refer back to these as we pass along to the next.
A strange force has entered the galaxy. The future of mankind is at stake. It could only mean one thing.
Greetings, Captain.
Spock!
I do not think you realize the gravity of your situation.
The vacation is over. Now, the crew of the Starship Enterprise.
Enterprise, are you ready?
Is taking adventure where it has never gone before.
What are you standing around for? Do you not know a jailbreak when you see one?
From the mind of a madman.
Hostile force has taken control of our vessel.
Mr. Sulu, full ahead.
Through the center of the galaxy.
You know we'll never make it through the Great Barrier.
To the final frontier.
Fascinating. How often have you done this?
Actually, it's my first attempt.
Fire the rockets!
You never cease to amaze me.
Nor I myself.
This is the boldest trek of all.
Warp speed now.
Star Trek V, the final frontier.
Mr. Scott, you're amazing.
There's nothing amazing about it. I know this ship like the back of my hand.
So Star Trek IV, this one was also, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home was directed by Nimoy. He got to do 3 and 4. And Shatner had basically said, well, if he gets to direct, I get to direct because I get everything he gets. They had a,
exactly
they'd had right. they'd had an agreement going back to the show, you know, that if one gets a raise, the other gets a raise. And if one gets to direct, the other gets to direct. So they actually let Shatner sort of come up with the story idea for 5. How would you say he did?
You know, it's weird because every time I think about 5, which is obviously a flawed movie, and I think everybody realizes that, I look at it as one of those things where I think Shatner, because it was his turn at bat, after Nimoy had done some really good movies and had actually done the highest grossing Star Trek movie up to that point with Star Trek IV, you know, I think Shatner felt some pressure and he really wanted to swing for the fences. Like, I think he said, I want to go back to something that's going to be a little more thought-provoking. I want something that's going to harken back to some of the best episodes of the show. I want something that is going to feature Kirk as much as possible.
Yeah.
Trying to solve a dilemma. So why not have Kirk meet God? And I think that was actually how it was pitched, that we're going to have the crew of the Enterprise meet an alien life form that says, I'm God.
And in, I guess in William Shatner's mind, he thought that Kirk finally needed to meet an adversary that was equal to him.
Exactly. All right. Well, and, you know, it's funny because, you know, he's not the first person that's done this. I mean, when you look at, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger went from, you know, being Conan the Barbarian to starting to do more action movies that were set in the modern day. And it was, okay, now he's going to fight the mob. Now he's going to be a Russian. Now, wait a minute. He can't just keep fighting people. So let's have him fight an alien. So that's how they made Predator. And then a couple of years later, well, he's fought aliens. Let's have him fight the devil. Mm-hmm. So it's constant escalation. And I think in Shatner's case, that's what it was. It was, well, who have they not encountered?
Yeah.
They've encountered, you know, every sort of alien that they could encounter. What would be a real dilemma to put them in? Well, if Kirk meets God, how does he handle that?
And everything I've read about, I read years ago William Shatner's Star Trek movie memories book where he talks a lot about this. I've read other things about it. The impression I get is that he had sort of an idea that basically involved meeting God, or at least looking for God, you know. And then it went through several rewrites, including Roddenberry objecting to parts of it. Several cast members objected to parts of it. They tried to get Nicholas Meyer or Harvey Bennett, to come back and work on it, but they were busy and couldn't do it. They ended up with a different screenwriter. Basically, this is what happens when about 15 different people take a topic that was probably not a good idea to start with, but they're just determined to make it work, and they just keep banging away on it until you get something that at least kind of works as a movie, but just not a very good movie.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. I mean, the Star Trek V is the classic example of, okay, now we've got a massive hit. because Star Trek IV grossed over $100 million at the box office. It kind of cemented Star Trek as a multi-billion dollar franchise for Paramount. And then all of a sudden you have people who up until that point weren't terribly interested in the creative side of it, all starting to put their two cents into it.
Yeah.
You know, and including the star of the entire franchise. And, you know, this was Shatner's opportunity to kind of take the bull by the horns and run with it. And I do think there's something to be said for swinging for the fences. I just think he missed horribly. And, you know, what you end up with is a dud because he struck out.
Yeah. I mean, Harvey Bennett had a pass at it. David Lowery, they couldn't get one of the people they wanted to get to work on it. It does have one thing I love about it, though. It finally gets David Warner into a Star Trek movie because I love David Warner so much.
And it's actually the first of, you know, like 40 gajillion appearances that he makes in Star Trek after that.
Yeah.
Because they used him for everything after that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love David Warner. He's great. He's currently, by the way, playing Kurt Wallander's dad on the Wallander mysteries that the BBC does with Kenneth Branagh.
Oh, with Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah.
Those are great.
Yeah. And I'm planning on doing a show on Wallander sooner or later. I just got to read more of the books. And I think there's one more season of the show coming. I wanted to mention the money. And also one other thing about what Shatner was trying to do with this movie. Star Trek IV had cost like 20-something million and made like 140 million. So a huge exponential return, relatively speaking. This one, Star Trek V, cost 33 million and earned 63 million. So again, you know, making its money back more or less, but when you get to Hollywood accounting, that's not really considered much of a, that's more of a John Carter of Mars success than a Star Trek success.
And here's the thing, and I'm not making this argument to defend the movie, the quality of the movie, but everybody likes to point at the box office because this was kind of like the first major stumbling that the franchise had taken. Yeah. But if you think about it, and I point this out all the time, the summer of 89 was really the first huge summer since summer movies became blockbuster entertainment. 2 weeks before Star Trek V came out, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade opened.
I thought that came out that summer, yeah.
Yeah. A week before Star Trek V, Dead Poets Society, which had opened very small because it was a drama, but it had Robin Williams coming off of Good Morning Vietnam and was getting huge buzz. The week before Star Trek opened, Dead Poets Society opened wide to more theaters. So it did actually open number one the week that it opened, but the week after it opened, Ghostbusters 2 came out, and then 2 weeks after that, so now we've got Last Crusade, Dead Poets Society, Ghostbusters 2, and Star Trek 5 are all in the theaters now.
Yeah.
2 weeks after Star Trek 5 opened, Batman.
Now that's right, 89, yeah.
And 89 was the summer of Batman.
Right.
So, I mean, 2 weeks after it opened, it had no chance. I mean, it was not going to be a huge movie if it had not made any money up to that point. Yeah. And the other movie that opened the same weekend as Batman was a little movie called Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which all of the overflow from Batman, I mean, remember the summer of 89 when Batman came out. I mean, we didn't have 20-screen multiplexes. So there were a lot of sold-out shows of Batman, and people had to say, oh, well, I can't get into Batman. What am I going to go see? A lot of them had kids, and a lot of them took them to see Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, not Star Trek V.
Yeah, and because the buzz for Star Trek V was pretty bad from the beginning.
But it's still – opening weekend, it still did roughly what the first four did. So, you know, it was not a great movie, and that had a lot to do with the box office. But I still point out, from a business standpoint, it was surrounded both before and after it came out by huge movies that summer. I mean, 89 was a huge summer movie season.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you get, like, a couple of weeks after Lethal Weapon 2 came out. So if it hadn't had bad buzz, I think it would have done a little bit better. And in the grand scheme of things, it didn't do that much worse box office wise than Star Trek 2 and Star Trek 3.
Yeah.
But I think it left a bad taste in everybody's mouth because it wasn't a great movie coming off of a really good movie in Star Trek IV.
And I think it's unfortunate. It has it has my favorite title, The Final Frontier, of all of them. I really like that. I wish it could have been a bit. And it had some neat ideas at work. I like the idea of Spock's half-brother who has some sort of mental powers and stuff, and he uses them proactively rather than just sort of the way Spock does. It has some good ideas and some good stuff going on, and it just wasn't able to really pull them all together. A couple other things. The Shatner wanted to, you know, it was interesting. You made the point in our previous episode that they sort of had to talk Shatner into doing Star Trek II as the older Kirk, who could be more cerebral and sort of less physical maybe as he's getting older. But it's funny because as the director of this one, he decides to have it to be the most physical of all of them.
Exactly.
So he's climbing. He's climbing a mountain. They're riding the horses.
The mountain always cracks me up. Yeah, because he actually had to have the opening of the movie be, you know, Kirk is free climbing El Capitan. I mean, that's crazy. But you have to prove that he can still get it done. So
yeah, and he was the director, so that's what they were going to do.
You know, the biggest piece of trivia about Star Trek V that I love talking to people about is, you know, obviously when they cast movies like this, everybody has like a wish list of people they want to go after. And the role of Cybok was obviously a big deal. And do you know who they actually went after first?
I do.
To play Spock's brother.
Because you just mentioned the movie that kept him from being in it.
Yes.
Sean Connery.
Sean Connery. But the trivia is not so much that Sean Connery turned them down and ended up doing Last Crusade. The trivia is, what's the name of the planet?
Oh, I don't know.
It's Shakari. And the reason it's Shakari is because they wanted to have an in-joke for Sean Connery turning them down.
Okay, that's great. Yeah. I always, when I think Sean Connery now, I think about the fact that he turned down Gandalf in Lord of the Rings and instead picked League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Not a bad movie, but Lord of the Rings, you know, Gandalf, I mean, you know. So he has a track record in that way of turning down things. But
well, and it always cracks me up that he turned down Star Trek V, but, you know, he's clearly done science fiction before, so that wasn't it. He's clearly done bad science fiction before because he was in Highlander 2, The Quickening. So, you know, it's not like, it's harder, you know, to get his track record of picking projects is the reason why he did it.
It's hard to get much badder.
Exactly.
Than that one. Wow. Ooh, I forgot. Yeah, so all right. So, yeah, this one, they search for God. They go to the center of the galaxy. It's got some neat stuff going on in it, but
There's some nice moments, but, I mean, collectively, it doesn't hang together.
Yeah. So let's roll on then into the sixth one.
The Klingon Empire has 50 years of life left to it.
To offer Klingons a safe haven within Federation space is suicide.
They're animals.
Jim, they are dying.
You, Captain Kirk, are to be our first olive branch.
Me?
The galaxy stands at a crossroads.
This is the Starship Enterprise. We've been ordered to escort you to your meeting on Earth.
Guess who's coming to dinner?
I have so wanted to meet you, Captain. One warrior to another?
Right. On the verge of peace.
The undiscovered country. Future.
On the brink of war.
We come in peace, and you blatantly defy that.
We haven't fired.
According to our databanks, we have.
I shall blow you out of the stars.
Now, the crew of the Starship Enterprise
will not be the instigators of full-scale war on the eve of universal peace.
They're coming about.
Battle stations.
Fights not to win battles.
Incoming.
Signal our surrender.
Captain?
We surrender!
But to end them forever.
Who
would consider an attempt to rescue them an act of war.
There will never be a better time.
This is Captain Sulu, USS Excelsior. We stand ready to assist you.
This is fun.
You do prefer it this way, as it was meant to be. Warrior to warrior.
You cannot take much more of this!
Cry havoc!
To you! And let's slip the dogs of war! Fire!
Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which several things. Let me quickly say that up front about this one. They had mentioned this title as possibly being used for an earlier one. I don't know if it was had the same plot, because they had talked about calling one of the earlier ones The Undiscovered Country. I clearly remember reading that somewhere.
I want to say that it was 3.
Yeah, it may have been.
Because they were dealing with Spock's death, but I'm not 100% certain about that.
It still was an odd title.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand it's metaphorical that peace is the undiscovered country, but it just, it sounds more like a movie set in the 15th century instead of the 23rd century. You know, it sounds more like a Columbus movie or something than a science fiction. But anyway.
Well, I don't know exactly what the line is, so I can't quote it, but I do know it's Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I know
And they quote a lot of Shakespeare in this movie too. So.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why they use it.
And the Klingon in it is really sort of a recycled Khan too. I mean, that's one negative I have about this movie is that it recycles a lot of Star Trek too, to a certain degree. But it does it in a way that I thought was very fresh and interesting, which was that this is the first post-Cold War Star Trek anything.
Right.
Because Star Trek V came out the summer before the big events in Eastern Europe, right? In the fall of 89, you have the Berlin Wall comes down and the Soviet Union starts to crumble and all that. And you saw the Soviet Union go from being this menacing archenemy of the United States to being a big, powerful military country that at the same time needs help and is asking for assistance from their archenemy.
Man, and that sounds vaguely familiar.
Yes. And so, and you had a power plant in that said big, great power that kind of melts down and causes an even bigger crisis where they have to ask for help. So you start this movie out with basically Chernobyl. And you have the Gorbachev of the Klingons coming to deal with basically the Richard Nixon, in a way, of the Federation, right? That's Kirk. He's the only Nixon can go to China. I mean, that's what he said, right? And they actually quote that in the movie, which is so funny to me. And so this was also, by the way, I believe the first movie where you get that cool explosion effect where the little ripples go out in a ring. Or did they add that later?
No, that was actually in the original cut of it, yeah.
Because after that, every explosion has that.
Yeah, it looked really cool the first time you saw it. The 15th time, not so much.
Exactly. So they blow up, the Klingon plant blows up. Yeah, so this one is actually a really neat movie. It's got kind of a murder mystery thing going on in it. It's got some good guest star, basically actors in it.
It's the second appearance of David Warner.
Yes,
he plays the Klingon Chancellor.
Yes.
Even though you kind of were divisive about them recycling Khan for the tone of the villain, Christopher Plummer makes like one of the best villains of the series.
Oh yeah.
I love him in this movie. And it's one of those things where, yeah, he's chewing scenery left and right, but it totally fits the character and it totally makes sense in the context of the story. And I love every scene he's in.
Yeah. Yeah. On its own, it's fantastic. It echoes a lot to me of having sort of Shakespeare quoting arch villain, you know, he's on the other ship doing sneaky stuff. It's very Khan-like, but he's very good at it.
We should point out that there's probably a reason for that because this was Nicholas Meyer's return to Star Trek.
Absolutely.
And there was a lot of behind the scenes things because Next Generation had already started.
That's right.
It had been on the air for several years, and they knew this was going to be the last movie with the original crew. So going into it, there's very much a finality to a lot of the proceedings as the story unfolds.
That's true.
And knowing that it was the final voyage of the original crew, you know, they kind of had to do some stuff story-wise to make it a good, epic, big finish for them, I guess. But it does, story-wise, it harkens back to, you know, the storytelling of the original series with the murder mystery. And, you know, there's two or three different plots going on at the same time that you have to follow because they, halfway through the movie, have Kirk and McCoy sent to the Klingon prison planet. So they have to deal with that and they have to escape while Spock is dealing with the murder mystery on the Enterprise. And it's a very well done how they kind of juggle all the balls at the same time.
Kim Cattrall's character, she was not Savick, was she?
She was not Savick.
But she could
character
have been.
Was actually Valeris, but in the original draft, it was supposed to be Savick.
That's what I thought, and it would have been very interesting to see her in that kind of a situation, I thought.
Well, and I actually believe that the original plan was Kirstie Alley was going to come back and play Savick.
Yeah.
And then that fell through. So they started negotiating with Kim Cattrall, and they decided to just change the character. I think they should have kept it Savick, even if they recast it for a third time.
I was going to say, they already had done it once.
Yeah, if they recast her again, Kim Cattrall would have made a perfectly fine Savick, and it would have made that character's part of the plot even more powerful, I think.
Yeah, because there's an investment already in that character.
Yeah, and the other thing, and I was thinking about this when I was driving home to get ready for this podcast, when they finally reveal that she's one of the people involved in the conspiracy, it would have been much more powerful if her explanation would have been to Kirk, you know, they're Klingons. We can't trust them. I was standing right next to your son when he was killed.
Oh, yeah.
I watched him die at Klingon hands.
Wow.
And I don't trust them. You shouldn't trust them either. You said all of these things about them, and I believe it too. So, you know, we're on the same page. It would have been much more powerful if it had been Savick rather than, you know, some generic Vulcan named Valeris who we have no history with.
Yeah, that would have been so good because then Kirk would have had to come back and say, sometimes you have to put that kind of thing aside for the bigger picture and the greater good
exactly,
and all
yeah.
that. And that would have been, yeah, that really would have been, wow. So,
although
too bad.
Having her be Vulcan, you know, whether it was Savick or somebody else, I love the one scene when they know it's her and they're trying to get the information about what's going to happen, what the plot is. And the only way they can get it is for Spock to mind meld with her. And there's that little hesitation where when he first goes and puts his hand on her face and she kind of pulls back and he grabs her and like forces himself on her. And I just love that because Spock is like really cold. And I mean, he's pissed at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of like I all that I've done for you career-wise and everything, that would have been much more powerful if it had been Savick.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And wasn't Savick half Romulan or something?
Exactly.
So that would have been interesting, too. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I remember about this movie was the trailer for it. And like you said, it came out after the TV show had been – the new TV show had been on for a bit. And so they really promoted this one as one last go-round with the old gang.
Yeah.
And I remember that the trailer kept showing clips from the old series, like the old series, you know, the 60s.
Right.
And then saying, you know, one last time. And they very much made it clear from the get-go that this was the last, you know, last roundup. And I wonder how everybody felt about that. I guess they were ready to start doing, you know, Next Generation movies, I suppose. Though Lord help us with the first one that they did. But
well, and wasn't the time when 6 came out in 91, so that was also the 25th anniversary of the show going on the air. So there was a lot of big Star Trek stuff happening because of that. And this was just kind of like the icing on the cake as far as, you know, that whole year of celebrating Star Trek's anniversary.
Yeah. And it did well. It earned almost $100 million worldwide. It cost less to make than 5, so there you go. You want me to really freak you out, Jim? In 2 years, it'll be the 50th anniversary of Star Trek.
Oh, I know. I was just thinking about that the other day, too.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, make me feel old. it's older than me, but the problem is it's not much older than me.
It's not much older, and the older it gets, the older I am.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, let's see. So any last thoughts about Star Trek VI? I pretty much shot my ammunition on this one, I think.
Yeah, because it was fun. You know, it's funny because I just started teaching another screenwriting class this week, and one of the things I closed my session with on Monday was, you know, regardless of what kind of screenplay you're trying to write, you know, whatever the genre is or the tone of it, at the end of whatever it is that somebody's watching, you want them to leave a theater feeling like they had an enjoyable experience. And every time I watch Star Trek VI, that's how I feel. Mm. I feel like, you know, is it the best of the six? No. Is it, you know, the most action-packed? No. Is it the funniest? No. But it's a really fun movie, and I really enjoy watching it. I enjoy all of the performances. You know, I think it's as close as the first one was to the original series as far as being the cerebral science fiction sort of a plot. Six is very much as close to the series got as far as telling a story about the modern condition. And like we talked about at the beginning of the conversation, you know, it's very much a post Cold War movie.
Yeah.
And how do we deal with that? And using the characters to kind of explore those themes is really fun to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's we got to mention there's the great gulag scene where they're in the Klingon prison or whatever, and you get some fun stuff with Kirk and is it McCoy? I haven't seen this movie in a while.
Yeah,
Kirk and McCoy in the prison. So
yeah, in fact, one of the all time best Star Trek lines out of the first six movies, because they encounter a shapeshifter that is going to help them escape from the gulag.
That's
and ends up being part of the conspiracy. And once they get out of range of the, you know, anti-transportation shield or whatever they have on the planet, the shapeshifter shifts into a doppelganger of Kirk so that you can have Kirk fight himself, which, I mean, you talk about in Star Trek V, we have Kirk fighting God. Well, you know, how do you top Kirk fighting God? Well, obviously he has to fight himself.
Exactly. I was just thinking the only way that you can go above Kirk fighting God is to go from God up to another Kirk.
Yeah, exactly.
Another William Shatner.
I mean, it's got,
if,
you know,
if only
great performances from everybody. It's, you know, it's a good Spock movie. It's a good Kirk and McCoy movie while they're together. You know, the one thing we didn't touch on this, and we'll do it real quick because I know you want to wrap up. This was like the beginning of the huge chasm between William Shatner and George Takei.
Oh, gosh.
Because if you remember Star Trek VI, Sulu's not on the Enterprise ever because he was promoted to captain of the Excelsior, and George was very happy about that. And Shatner, if you see interviews with him talking about it, he always points out, but it's about the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Like, why would you lobby the producers to put you on another ship? Like, all the action's on the Enterprise.
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, Shatner makes the point. It's like he thinks he actually got a promotion in the military.
Yeah, he actually got a promotion, right.
But from Takei's point of view, I guess if you can't stand Shatner, then it is a promotion.
It is a promotion because he gets to be away by himself.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and there's a great Peter David novel that's based on Sulu being the captain of that ship and his daughter. It's called The Captain's Daughter, I believe, right?
Where that is a very good novel.
Yeah. So, all right. So let's do our. We did this for the first three. Let's give our letter grade for each of these. Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home.
Ooh, four. Hmm. It's kind of like we talked in the first episode about, you know, how our feelings about the motion picture have changed over the years. Like, my feelings about Star Trek IV have changed a lot over the years.
Okay.
Because I absolutely loved it like everybody else when it came out. And now I'm feeling less in love with it as time goes on. It's a solid B for me. I mean, it's not the greatest. I mean, there's some humor in it. There's, you know, the plot's okay. But, you know, it is what it is. They had to have an ending to the trilogy from 2, 3, and 4. So I give it a B.
Yeah, I think B to B plus for me. It still holds up. I just rewatched several of these, not 5 and 6, but 1, 2, 3, and 4 recently. And it still holds up pretty well for me. So I give it a good B to B plus. Yeah. Star Trek V: The Final Frontier.
I hate to be too hard on it because... Yeah. You know, everybody just kind of like beats it to death. I mean, C minus or a C maybe. I mean, there's some good stuff in it, but I just, like I said earlier, I think they were trying too hard and there were too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Like I said, I haven't watched in a while. I'm going to go ahead and Netflix it in 6 in the next couple of weeks just because I want to finish the series out again. But from what I remember, I would agree with that.
The one thing I do enjoy about it is Lawrence Luckinbill is really good as Spock's half-brother, Sybok.
Yeah.
Although I still want to know how many people were on the short list between Sean Connery and Lawrence Luckinbill. Like, how many other people turned down the part before they got to him? Because he's not somebody that you would automatically go, oh, yeah, he should be a villain in a Star Trek movie.
You know, the story I read somewhere was that Shatner, when they couldn't get Connery... He just saw him on a TV, on a movie or something, and called him up.
It just said, okay.
Yeah.
So he was literally the next choice. That's funny.
And he just immediately accepted because he's like, be on a Star Trek movie? Heck yeah. You know,
yeah,
so,
yeah,
that's what I, you know, so, okay. And, Star Trek VI: Undiscovered Country.
Ooh, I really like that one a lot. I hate to put it up in the A range, but I mean, it's a B plus, almost an A minus. I mean, it's right there.
I'm going to give Star Trek VI, B plus. I think I never liked it as much as most people at the time, because like I said, a lot of it felt recycled to me and the whole look, it's Gorbachev and the Soviet Union was clever in a way, but at that time it was also a little tiresome to me because as a political scientist, I had been buried in that stuff for years. I like to get away from that kind of thing with my science fiction. So having to like dig back into it was not, you know, it was like, okay, that's neat, but I don't want to sit through like 2 hours of it. So B to B plus, it's something there. Let's rate the 6 of them in order.
Okay.
I'm
going to have to remember what I rated on the first episode.
We'll just say this is a different rating. This is just sort of in relation to each other off the top of your head. So don't worry about consistency. We won't worry. a foolish consistency is a hobgoblin of small minds, Jim. Don't let that worry you. I'm going to go in the order from my favorite to my least favorite. I'm going to go 1, 2, 4, 6, 3, 5.
Okay. So, all right. Doing it that way, I'm going to have to say 2 and then 1 and then Search for Spock. So 2, 1, 3 and then 6, 4, and 5.
Wow. Okay. So you've got the first three ahead of all the others.
Yeah.
So you have 4 next to last. Okay.
Yeah, because I mean, really.
Well, you like 3 more than I do. That's the difference.
Well, and that's the thing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was cool. Let's see. Any final thoughts about Star Trek, the first 6 movies in general, before we beam on out of here?
You know, it's funny. The more time goes on, the more I love the original crew. And I don't know if you are watching the original series off and on anymore like I am. I don't know if you get MeTV in your area, but Saturday nights they run Star Trek, or they start off with the 60s Batman show. Now they're showing Wonder Woman after Batman and then Star Trek. So it's like Science Fiction Saturday. And I love it. And I've been catching up on the original series. So doing this, it was kind of like, this is why I love those six movies as much as I do. Because the original cast and the original crew, it's all character driven. And I feel like even though they only had 3 years on the air, there is so much packed into those three seasons. And there's so much packed into the six movies that, you know, it just blows everything else that came after it out of the water, I think.
Yeah, I think I love all of these better than, with the possible exception of First Contact, better than any of the Next Generation movies. I just don't like the Next Generation cast that much. But that's a whole other topic.
I was going to say, when we do the third part of the trilogy and cover the the Next Generation movies, that's when we can get the knives out and really kind of like hack at them.
And we will do that. All right. Well, the White Rocket's got to beam on out of here to the Final Frontier and other assorted Star Trek cliches. Jim, thank you so much for doing this two-parter with me. It's been a real pleasure. Tell folks again how they can find your stuff.
They can go to midnight-entertainment.com, and here shortly everything will be rebooted, and 15th anniversary Swindlers of Doom stuff will be up there, so they can check all that out.
Awesome. And don't forget, folks, to go by whiterocketbooks.com, www.whiterocketbooks.com. That's, a lot of my stuff is there. I have stuff with other publishers too, but the stuff that's through White Rocket is there. The sister show of this program is the AU Wishbone podcast with John Ringer and me, if you're into football, although I imagine only a tiny fraction of our listening audience for this show would be into that. Once again, I want to thank, by the way, the Earth Station One Network. It's so cool to be part of that group and to be back on the air now with a new season of shows. We've got a few coming up in the near future. We're going to have John Quiring come back. We're going to have John Ringer come back. Bobby Polite's lined up. We've got several new topics. Mark Buskett and I are going to be in a couple of weeks digging into the Cold War films of the 80s. So I guess Star Trek VI might come up in a way. So I hope you'll tune in for that. But as for now, we are out of time. The Rocket's got to get out of here. Jim, take it easy, and we'll see you down the road.
Thanks, man.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.